Lastly, we'll be examining when God isn't green from the title of a book by our guest, Boston University Law Professor Jay Wexler, who has looked into, quote, places where religious practice and environmentalism collide.
We'll ask him about some of his observations, which range from a Ganesh festival in India to Palm Sunday in Minneapolis, and from bowhead whales in Alaska to an eagle repository in Colorado.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Baker's Birkenstock, featuring more than 30 brands of footwear, socks, purses, and hats. Baker's Birkenstock has been serving our community for over 40 years, with locations at 333 Broadway Street in downtown Chico and at 5781 Clark Road in Paradise. We're also brought to you by Chico Skywatch, a local not-for-profit group committed to increasing community awareness of deliberate aerosol spraying from jet aircraft. Chico Skywatch believes that the fallout from these artificial clouds is contaminating our air, water, and soil, as well as worsening the drought by disrupting the rain cycle. Find more information at chicoskywatch.org.
The opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of the staff, board of directors, volunteers, or programmers of KZFR. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Jay Wexler about religious practices and environmentalism. You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We recently received a book from Beacon Press. It's titled When God Isn't Green. It's a discussion of, quote, places where religious practices and environmentalism collide. It's a fascinating book that discusses these issues in depth and also with a sense of humor. We're pleased to have the author Jay Wexler on the phone with us tonight. Jay received an MA from Chicago Divinity School and a Doctor of Jurisprudence from Stanford. He presently teaches at Boston University Law School, where he specializes in environmental law and church-state law. Welcome, Jay Wexler.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on the program.
Yes, you're welcome.
Well, we've enjoyed reading the book and are eager to talk to you about some of the topics there and the places you have visited. Perhaps we could start, though. Tell us a little more about yourself and the evolution of your interest in environmentalism and religion.
Well, the interest in religion is the more complicated one, I guess. I grew up Jewish, but hated Hebrew school and quickly became an atheist at some point. But then when I got to college, I started getting really into Asian studies, Chinese and Japanese, and I started getting really interested in Taoism and Buddhism and started taking religion classes as part of my East Asian studies major. And then was going to do a PhD in Chinese religions, except my language skills weren't very good, so that's why I didn't finish my PhD at the Divinity School. And when I went to law school, I was still interested in religion, so I started focusing on law and religion issues. Environmental law kind of comes from practice. I was at the Justice Department after I graduated from law school, and I was just happened to have some environmental projects that I got kind of randomly, and I got kind of interested in that. And so when I started teaching, they needed somebody to teach environmental law, and I said, I'll do it. And I've been teaching it now for 14 years, but it's something that's kind of gradually come along as opposed to the religion thing, which has always been there.
And you like to visit places where there have been legal controversies. Your first book was called Holy Hullabaloos and had to do with places where you visited places where there's just been conflict over the law.
Yeah, well, I spent my first 6 years teaching out of the book with the cases and all the words and everything, and then I had the sabbatical, and I wanted to write a book about law and religion, and then it kind of occurred to me, mostly after I read Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell, that I could go on a road trip and sort of check things out in person. So I decided to go to these places where these cases came from, and I realized you learn a lot when you get out of the office and you go and you meet people and you visit the places where the controversies came from. And so I've been interested in doing that ever since.
In the introduction, you cite historian Lynn White, who's blamed the Christian view of domination over nature for many of the world's environmental problems. But you also note that religion over the world, and this is a quote, religions have done a lot of good for the environment. So help us understand the extent of this debate of the good that religion has done and the damage that religion has done.
Well, it's certainly the relationship between religion and the environment is really complicated. And I'm not an expert on the larger sort of question of, on the whole, is religion beneficial for the environment or not? There are certainly ways in which religion, I think, has been kind of harmful to the environment, to the extent it makes people have a different kind of epistemological approach to the world than a scientific one, and so that leads to all sorts of problems when science shows that there's an environmental problem. On the other hand, there are religions that teach respect and stewardship for the natural world, and so some religions do a lot of really positive things for the environment. What I'm interested in primarily is not kind of the bigger questions of whether on the whole religion is good or bad for the environment, but simply to look at the situations that I found around the world where religious practices actually happen to have harmful effects on the environment, and to think about what we might do in those situations. So I don't really take a position on whether, you know, religion is on the whole good or bad for the environment. That's kind of beyond the scope of the book. Fascinating and important question for sure, but kind of beyond me to address.
In the introduction, too, you talk about variously air, land, water, wildlife. Could you give us an example or two of your observations in those categories?
Sure. I'm trying to catalog the ways in which you see religious practices harm the environment around the world in those four categories. So, for example, let's see, incense burning, which is pretty common in various religious traditions, turns out to be incredibly bad for the air. It's really harmful to breathe in. It's almost as bad as cigarettes, one researcher told me in Hong Kong. Let's see, land. Religious pilgrimages, if you think about it, people, millions, I can't remember what the number, it could be 100 million, something like that, people per year go on religious pilgrimages. And if you imagine that many people going to the same place, it turns out that causes a lot of destruction to the land along the route. And in fact, there are even now some consciousness about that, and there's an eco-pilgrimage kind of organization that's there to try to help ameliorate that problem. Water, well, if you think about India and the Ganges River, for example, and the idea of putting your ashes, or even your kind of corpse. Laying your corpse, the corpse of a loved one, into the river because the river is sacred, that obviously causes all sorts of problems. And then the last one, animals. Animal sacrifices is one example. It turns out also that people kill elephants for their ivory, and a lot of that ivory is for religious uses. So the market for religious for ivory trinkets and ivory idols and things like that is a big part of the market for illegal ivory, which has contributed to the decimation of elephant populations in Africa. So those are just four out of many, many examples that I talk about in the book where you see religious practices in these various areas of the environment doing harm.
We just have mic problems again. Each of the chapters in the book focuses on one of your travels. And one of the most dramatic focuses on a festival celebrating Ganesh, the elephant-headed god of India. What happens at this festival, and how does it come to be a conflict with the environment?
This festival is incredible. It was definitely the highlight of my travels for the book. It's a festival that takes place over about 10 days in India, mostly in Mumbai and the state in which Mumbai is in, but other places as well. And as you say, Ganesh is an elephant-headed god, and people build idols or make idols of Ganesh. Some of them are maybe 2 feet tall, but there are also many of them which are 15, 20, 25 feet tall. And they're all over the city. There's maybe 100,000 of them altogether. Most of them are of the small variety, and they're in people's houses, but there are many, many which are in public places and are huge, and they're beautifully painted, and they're bejeweled, and they're extraordinary to look at. And so what happens over the course of these 7 to 10 days, the Hindus from the Mumbai area and all over India really come, and they go visit these Ganesh idols, and they worship the Ganesh idols. And sometimes, for some of the famous Ganesh idols, there can be lines of 2-3 hours long before you can just get in to see a glimpse of these beautiful idols. Anyways, it goes on for 7 to 10 days. It's an amazing, extraordinary festival. But then what happens at the end is that people take the idols, including the really big ones, which are paraded through the streets of Mumbai, and bring them to the water's edge, the Arabian Sea, for example, and then just walk them into the water and leave them there. And it's sort of supposed to symbolize the departure of the god for the year and also the impermanence of life. But unfortunately, these plaster of Paris idols don't disappear. They just sit there in the bottom of the ocean, bottom of the sea, and they break up and they cause all sorts of water pollution problems, which is terrible for the environment, but incredible to witness. I remember I was sitting there on the beach with like a million people in Mumbai, and these giant 25-foot beautiful statues of Ganesh come to the water's edge, and then they're just driven out into the sea. And it looked like the Rose Bowl parade, except that instead of stopping in the Pacific Ocean, it just kept on going. It was amazing.
Wow. So we can guess at the problem, but what are the environmental problems then created by dumping the idols?
Well, I think it's partially it's particulate matter, silt, that gets into the water. It's also, the things are really, really big. So I think I'm no scientist, but there are studies that are done that show that the water quality is degraded and that animal fish life is destroyed and things like that, because the plaster of Paris just doesn't dissolve, which is why people want to why environmentalists anyways want to have these things made out of clay so that they could dissolve, but that's a big controversy and doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon.
There has been a lawsuit over this. Could you describe now how law and religious practice start to perhaps get in each other's way a little bit?
Right. So in India, in one of the states right next to the state that Mumbai is in, the government there, in fact, went forward, took the recommendations of the eco-Ganesh people, the environmentalists, and attempted to prohibit the use of plaster of Paris idols. And the sculptors' lobby, which is a huge force in India, lots and lots of people make their living sculpting. I visited some of them, and it's an art form, in addition to the way they make their money, the sculptors' union sued, And the case went to something called the Green Court of India, and I'm no expert in Indian law by any means, but this court decided that the state had exceeded its constitutional authority in prohibiting the Plaster of Paris idols. So the sculptors won, the environmentalists lost, and so Plaster of Paris continues to be used. That was that particular legal controversy.
We were in India when they had a festival, and we cannot remember what this festival was for, but they everywhere in the streets, people were making very large, like the size of a person, heads of made out of bamboo, and then covering them with paper. And this went on for probably a week when they were making those, right? And mm-hmm. and then at the end of the week, during the festival, they were all burned. And, you know, again, it's one event, but the smoke from, as a result of building these for one event and then burning them was pretty significant.
Yeah, I think, I'm not familiar with that festival, but it doesn't surprise me given the number of and extravagance of the festivals that are in India. And it doesn't surprise me that a one-day event could cause all sorts of environmental and health problems. In Israel, every year there's a holiday called Lag BaOmer where people make bonfires throughout the country to worship a rabbi. It's complicated. I don't know if I completely understand the ritual, but the result is that you can actually see the smoke plumes from space. And
oh my gosh.
You can also track the increase in ER admissions for things like asthma attacks go way up on that night. So completely understandable that you know, one night's burning could cause all sorts of damage.
You also, in the chapter on Ganesh, talk about this as an issue of equality and poverty. Could you explain, please, how you got to that argument?
Yeah, so the argument there is that it relates to the debate about plaster of Paris versus clay. Idols used to be made out of clay. The problem with clay is that it's more difficult to make the idols. They're heavier and they're more expensive than the plaster of Paris idols. And so the fact that they're more expensive means that if the government, for example, required people to use clay idols instead of plaster of Paris idols, then there would be far fewer people who could actually purchase an idol. Mumbai is 20 million people, and many, many, many of them are very poor. And so even a small kind of difference in price can make a big difference as to whether somebody can worship as they wish. And so that I think is a concern, because it's, the idea of having a government regulation which essentially says, well, the wealthy can celebrate in one way, but the poor cannot, is something that, especially in a country like India, seems to be problematic to me.
And obviously that would affect the sculptors and the sculptors union as well, if fewer people
That's
are
right.
able to purchase.
Yep, absolutely.
You have another chapter about Singapore called Singapore Smoke, the Technological Fixes and the Impacts of Regulation. And this one is about burning joss in Southeast Asia. Can you tell us a little bit about that tradition? What are people expressing through this tradition?
Sure. It's the burning of joss goes on, I think, kind of regularly over the year, but it becomes a really, really big deal during what's called the Hungry Ghost Festival.
And can you just explain joss before we go any further
sure.
with that?
Joss, it's just basically paper. That's paper money, really, mm-hmm. for the most part, like really small bills, not dollar bills, but bills. Sometimes they have the Bank of Hades or something written on them, and so there's stacks and stacks of paper money. And actually, these days, it's not just paper money, but people make things like iPods out of paper and houses out of paper. You can burn basically anything, but it's all made out of paper. It's a certain kind of paper, and the studies that have been done show that the burning of this paper releases all sorts of carcinogens. So people get together all of this paper during what's called Hungry Ghost Week Festival, and they burn it in enormous amounts as a way of appeasing the ghosts, the ancestors, making sure they're happy, making sure that they're not going to cause problems in Earth, because this is the time when the ghosts are sort of let out of the next world and come back to Earth. And so the amount of paper that's burnt during this this period in Singapore, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, those are the places I visited, it's extraordinary. I went to one place. I talked to a Taoist who told me about a place I should go if I wanted to really see this, and it was a place kind of on the outskirts of Hong Kong where probably a million people came in one day, and there was this furnace that I sort of way in the back that people were all walking towards with their giant bags of joss, and they were just burning tons and tons of this paper, and it was just being belched into the air in this black soot, which ruined my white linen pants, which
was a
mistake on my part. But it was pretty amazing. You could really see the pollution.
And so what are the efforts? And I wanted to ask you one other question first. So is this a Taoist practice? Does this come from Taoist tradition? Or is it like just an ancestral practice that is a part of the particular location? Or how?
Yeah, I think it's primarily a Taoist. It's primarily a Taoist practice. Though it was interesting, people, depending on the country, people either identify exclusively as Taoist or not. So if I'm remembering correctly, a religious scholar, a sociology religion scholar in Singapore was explaining that that people there are either Buddhist or they're Taoist, and if you're Taoist, you're going to burn it. If you're Buddhist, that you don't. But in Hong Kong, it was different, and people are much more likely to sort of have syncretic beliefs where they're both, identify both with Taoism and Buddhism. But ultimately, I think it is identified with religious Taoism and Taoist traditions.
And what are the efforts now to deal with the amount of pollution? Do people recognize that they're suffering as a result of this, and that's why they seek out a technological fix for this?
I think that there is a lot of consciousness about the dangers of the pollution, for sure. In Singapore, there are signs all over the place telling people to burn less joss and don't burn it in a place where the smoke will basically fly in your neighbor's face. You know, if you burn it on your porch, for example, and the smoke's going to go to your next door neighbor, who's not going to be very happy. So there are all sorts of public service signs to that effect. People know it's dangerous, and as a result, different countries have approached regulating it in different ways. So in Hong Kong, right, as you mentioned, there are technological regulations where the Hong Kong Environmental Protection Agency basically will implement these restrictions that require certain technology to reduce the amount, for furnaces and temples, to reduce the amount of noxious smoke that it's emitted. And in Taiwan, I think it's they really trying to think if they actually ban it or, I guess I can't remember exactly, but there are even stronger efforts in Taiwan to deal with the problem at the large sort of temple level.
And so do people see this as an infringement in their religious freedom, or do they see perhaps that religion can support the environment as opposed to being in conflict with it? Or is that even a conversation?
Well, I think it depends who you ask. Like, I went and I talked to the people who are, work at the Taoist Association of Hong Kong, and they, at least the person I talked to, pretty much resented the government regulation, saying, look, this is our religious practice. We've been doing it for, forever. And let's face it, this is not the biggest environmental problem facing Hong Kong right now. Okay. Some Taoist burning paper for a week, which is certainly true. Nothing in my book is meant to suggest that religious sources of environmental harm are the biggest or most dangerous sources. So he was pretty angry about the regulations and thought that the Taoists should be able to use the money that they're going to have to spend to fix their furnaces to do other things like feed, the homeless or something like that. So there's definitely some conflict about it.
We're going to take a break in just a moment, Jay Wexler, but I want to ask a question. My dear wife and co-host says this is a bad question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Because we know the answer.
The title, because, yes, we know what you're going to say. She knows what you're going to say.
I know what you're going to
the
say.
The title is When God Isn't Green, but is it really God or is it people doing things in the name of God that are anti-environmental?
Think about that.
Definitely the latter. But it's interesting that you say that because there was this was a discussion we had at the press, this exact point somebody made, and we thought about it because you're right. I mean, it's a little deceptive, and I'm not trying to say that God is green. It's sort of a, try to find a catchy title kind of thing. But you're completely right to point out that it's, I don't mean to say that God isn't green. It's the people who are worshiping God or some version of a God who are not always green.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Jay Wexler, who is an award-winning teacher at Boston University School of Law. And we're talking about religious practices that conflict with environmentalism. We're just going to take a short break here and then come back and ask Jay about some practices and legal issues that are a bit closer to home.
Guru Narayan, Guru Narayan, Guru Narayan, Guru Narayan, Guru Narayan, 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 Guru
where we're speaking with Jay Wexler. He's the author of When God Isn't Green, recently published by Beacon Press. Also over the weekend, I discovered that Jay is a novelist as well, and I read your novel, Tuttle in the Balance, a fun and informative read. This is about, it's about the Supreme Court. Now, you were a clerk for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, were you not? And you must have gotten some of the material for Tuttle in the Balance there.
Yeah, I did. I worked for Justice Ginsburg in 1998 and 1999. And I guess I got the sort of the feel for the court that I was able to hopefully capture in the book. I mean, there's nothing specific from that year or anything that's in the book, but just kind of knowing what it's like to be there and what the clerks do and how the justices interact with the clerks, or at least could interact with the clerks, and things like that all kind of made it their way into the book in various ways, yeah.
It gave me a sense, yes, of what the court must be like. And listen, this is not too much of a spoiler alert. There's a great fight scene where the justices who get on each other's nerves get into it and appear bruised and bandaged when they walk into the court. And the press is mightily amused by this and curious as to what's happened. A very good book. Thank you.
It's true. A fracas may or may not have broken out in the conference room.
Right. We'll get back to When God Isn't Green. And we want to ask in this segment about some episodes, some cases closer to home. Could you explain, you have a chapter on this, that's a 2000 law called the Religious Land Use and Institutional Persons Act. What did this mean to the Rocky Mountain Christian Church of Boulder, Colorado, when they wanted to expand their footprint?
Right, so it's a complicated story. I'm trying to think about how far to go back, but this law... Well, let's see. There's been a consistent controversy in United States law over the last many, many years about whether the government can apply general laws or regulations to religious organizations or people if those laws burden the person or the institution's religious practices. And the Supreme Court originally said, no, the government can't do that. And then the Supreme Court changed its mind and said, yes, the government can do that. And then Congress came back and enacted a couple of statutes, including the statute that you referred to, which basically says that if the government wants to apply a general zoning law or land use law within its territory, it can't apply that law to religious institutions unless it meets a really, really high standard and can show that it has the greatest interest, and that it's done, it's implemented, it's pursued this interest in the most narrow way possible to burden religion the least. So the result is that municipalities are often prohibited by the statute from enforcing zoning or land use laws against churches, and so. And so many of these zoning laws these days are enacted to protect environmental kinds of concerns like sprawl and excess parking and traffic and things like that. The law that you mentioned, our LUPA, it's called, doesn't get in the way of environmental goods or benefits. So this Rocky Mountain Church in Boulder wanted to expand enormously, which was going to have deleterious environmental impacts, and the city didn't want to let it. It was a violation of the zoning laws, and the church sued, and the church won under the statute. Basically, the city of Boulder was kind of powerless to pursue its environmental goals at the expense of this church. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it did make sense, and I'm just wondering if... How common that is, how often that comes into play, and then what you see as kind of the church's environmental attitudes under those circumstances.
Yeah, well, I think certainly lawsuits under the statute are pretty common.
Hmm.
I think the Boulder case was unique in this because it was so big. The expansion was really substantial, and I'm not sure that that's true most of the time. In fact, it probably isn't. And certainly there must, I don't know enough about this but to be sure, but I would imagine that there are many churches who are concerned with their environmental footprint and would, think about that when deciding whether to expand or how to expand. So it's not like churches are out there, willy-nilly expanding, destroying the environment.
Right,
but it is once in a while you do have these kind of conflicts, and religion kind of trumps the environment in those circumstances.
You've also done some time with the National Eagle Repository of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that functions... in part as a result of the Golden Eagle Protection Act. So what does the Golden Eagle Protection Act do, and how does that impact religious practices?
Right, so this is the story that got me interested in this whole topic to begin with.
Okay.
I think it's the most fascinating conflict between religion and the environment in the United States. So there's many Native Americans believe that eagles are sacred, both bald and golden eagles, and use bald and golden eagles, or want to use bald and golden eagles, or their parts, their feathers, for example, as part of their religious rituals. The United States has, since 1940, prohibited the possession of any part of a golden or bald eagle under this act that you mentioned, and it was intended to protect the national symbol. It was originally protecting the bald eagle, and it was expanded to the golden eagle because young golden eagles look like young bald eagles.
Oh, okay, I was wondering.
So it's to protect the national symbol, which, of course, was ecologically in big trouble for a long time, but now is sort of off the endangered list, but there's still controversy about whether it's in danger or not. Anyways, so we have this conflict between Native American religious needs and environmentalism, protection of the eagle. The government recognizes that conflict, and the primary way that it's sought to balance the two interests between Native American religion and protecting the eagle is by setting up this agency you mentioned, the National Eagle Repository, which is a small building with four people who work there outside of Denver, Colorado, and the only thing they do there is collect dead bald and golden eagles. Like, people send the state wildlife agency or whatever, if they come across a dead bald eagle, they send it to this place, and they at the eagle repository process the eagles, look through the dead eagles, see what they can salvage and what needs to be thrown away, and then they take whatever they can salvage and they send the parts, feathers usually, but sometimes the whole birds or a head or who knows, to Native American tribes who have applied to receive those parts.
So it's
an unbelievably fascinating place. Like, I wish I could ask the listenership, like, to raise your hand if you've heard of this place. It's
never.
Extraordinary. And so I went and I visited and I watched them take apart these bald eagles, and I learned all about bald eagles and saw lots of dead eagles, which wasn't very pleasant, but it's pretty incredible.
So the only reason the repository exists is to serve this need of some Native American tribes, is that right?
That's right.
Oh, mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, incredible.
But you also say in that chapter, you allude to effects of these kinds of laws in other areas. You mentioned Mormon polygamy, Seventh-day Adventists who were fired for refusing to work on Saturday, and one I'd like to hear about, peyote taking members of the Native American Church. Could you explain how the echo effects here?
Oh, so those are not... I mentioned those controversies... just as part of the context of this dispute in general about whether government can regulate religion through general laws.
Yes.
Not particularly with respect to the environment. Mm-hmm. So those are, I was just telling the story of how the Supreme Court has gone back and forth on how much protection to provide religion, and those cases have involved things like polygamy, Adventists working on Saturday, and peyote. The peyote case is the really big case from 1990, where two people were fired for using peyote, and then they were denied unemployment benefits because they didn't have good cause for being fired, basically. And the question was basically, could the government apply a general law that prohibits peyote to people who believe they need to use peyote if it's part of their religious ritual? And the Supreme Court, kind of reversing its view that it had for say 30 years, in an opinion by Justice Scalia, said the government can insist upon its general laws regardless of religion, because otherwise we would have a system of anarchy. So that's what those cases were about.
One of the chapters in your book, and Steve keeps talking about this, it really fascinates him, is... the one from Palm Sunday in Minneapolis and deforestation in Guatemala. So I had no idea that there was a huge demand for palms on Palm Sunday, even though as a child I was a Christian and we did Palm Sunday. So can you tell us what's going on here?
Sure, right. So every year, millions of Christians are celebrating Palm Sunday, and everybody carries these palms, and they come from somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And it turns out they come from a small area of forests in the state of Chiapas, Mexico, and western Guatemala, and Belize, and some other places. And the demand for these palms was helping contribute to the deforestation of these forests. I mean, it wasn't by any means the only demand for palms. Palms are also used as part of floral decorations and things like that. We're not talking, you know, the giant Florida coconut palm trees,
right,
but smaller palm trees, which are still, and bushes and things like that, which are still incredibly important for the forest. But the Palm Sunday was part of it, part of the demand that, and these, the people who take care of these forests and live near these forests are very poor, and so the incentive had been to just go and collect as many palms as fast as possible and send them off to people in the United States, and that was just destroying the forests. Now, the governments down there and the environmental NGOs, and especially the villagers, some enlightened villagers who realize what we're destroying these forests that we live on, you know, in and need, realized that this was a problem and started implementing methods of sustainable harvesting of these palms, so that they only take some palms and sometimes and let other palms, you know, go without harvesting them. They harvest only certain leaves and not other leaves. Complicated system. But the thing is, that's really expensive, and it cuts into their profits, and it's not clear that that they can do it in the long run. So one thing that's helped them do it is this project called the Eco Palms Project, which is started at University of Minnesota by a forestry economic professor. And basically what his project does is, and it's pretty big now, is congregations around the United States basically pay extra to get sustainably harvested palms that get like the seal of it, just like your fair trade coffee or something like that.
Right.
And the extra money goes then to these villages to help the villages, you know, make up the deficit that they, you know, incur because they're not willy-nilly cutting down the forest. And in fact, there's a surplus, and that is goes to help the villagers make schools and provide insurance for older people and health care and all sorts of things. So it's a great kind of win-win situation, I think, for everybody. The forests get to survive, the villagers get money, the parishioners are doing the right thing, and it's kind of a great story.
Yeah.
It's clearly a cooperative story, and I'll take that as a segue. Throughout the book, as you said earlier, you're very cautious. You don't make judgments about particular religions or religious practices, and you're also quite wary of government intervention as a solution to some of these problems. In the concluding chapter, you do suggest that a partial solution to many of these problems could be, quote, collectivizing the religious practice. And I wonder if you could explain what that is and how that might work.
Right. So throughout the book, I'm wary of sort of telling religious people what they should do, because why should they listen to me? I'm not in their tradition. I'm an atheist. They know that. So I'm wary about that. But I do make this suggestion, as you say, and hope that maybe, you know, somebody finds that find some audience among religious groups. And the idea is, would it be possible to, instead of every single believer, you know, doing the religious practice, would it be possible for people to get together in communities and practice in a way that would have fewer environmental impacts? So does everybody need to have a Ganesh idol, or could it be possible for, you know, 1,000 people to decide to worship one and immerse just the one instead of 1,000? Or, you know, could we burn less paper because we're burning it as a community instead of each individual? And I'm just hoping that, you know, is something that religious groups and people who care, religious people who care about the environment might consider, because it would be a way of maintaining, I think, a lot of the religious, you know, the vitality of religious practice while also benefiting the environment.
So as you observed and talked to people as you traveled around the world, what did you see in terms of that kind of consciousness, that kind of deliberate sense that we can engage in collective practice in order to be more careful about the environment. Did you see that, or is it like a hope? Or
yeah, I mean, it's more a hope. It depends on the context. Each of these things, places, and controversies turns out to be pretty different. India, for example, there's definitely a lot of environmental consciousness now about the Ganesh Festival and other festivals, but at the same time, these festivals are so important, and mm-hmm. they're so such a force in the community that I think it's going to be very hard to reduce the impacts of those, except in kind of the long term. I think it's kind of going to be very incremental. Doing things like convincing people not to use lead paint, mm-hmm. maybe, or mm-hmm. not to take off the jewels before putting it in the mm-hmm. in the water, things like that. Some places, I think, there's a problem with money. Like some of the religious practices are part of a business, and when that happens, it becomes much more difficult to, you know, convince people out of the goodness of their heart to, you know, do something good for the environment. And in those cases, those are the cases, and we haven't talked about them, I don't think, specifically, but there are some cases in the book where basically law is going to have to step in,
right.
In order to basically force people to stop doing certain practices because the practices are so lucrative. And in other situations, I think, like with the Joss paper idea, a problem, there is definitely a feeling that there can be compromises. It's tricky. It's difficult because some people, you know, feel very strongly that their religious practices should be able to, you know, they should practice their religion any way they want, and their contribution to environmental harm is so small.
Right. I was thinking.
You know, so it's an ongoing effort. We're certainly not there yet, but you see glimmers of hope here and there around the world for sure.
I can see in places like Singapore and in places in India, people saying, well, in the overall scheme of things, given the enormity of the environmental problems that we have to face, that this religious practice seems minimal, and it seems more important to maintain the religion than make this minimal effort.
Yeah, I think that's a persuasive, you know, I mean, that argument has appeal for sure. When you're looking at the contribution of, you know, manufacturing or mm-hmm. transportation to air pollution in Hong Kong, and you compare that to the amount of stuff that pollution that comes from the Joss burning, you know, there's no competition there. The religion is not the one that's putting us over the
right.
edge. On the other hand, you know, every bit of pollution
right.
is harmful. And if you're one of those people who happens to live in a house, you know, or apartment or whatever, right next to a place where you have a furnace belching out this air, this dirty air, smoke, that's a problem.
Mm.
And so it's minor, but it can still have important effects, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The book we've been discussing tonight on Ecotopia is When God Isn't Green, A Worldwide Journey to Places Where Religious Practice and Environmentalism Collide. It's published by Beacon Books. And we've been speaking with the author, Jay Wexler. Jay teaches at the Boston University Law School. We want to thank you very much. We've enjoyed the discussion. Thank you for being with us on Ecotopia tonight.
Thank you very much. This was really fun.
It was fun. Thanks.
God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. There's no place to run and hide, for he knows where you're at. God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that. Every wrong thing that you do, God's gonna get you for that.
This doggone world we're living in, it's giving me a fit. It seems like everywhere I turn, I see a hypocrite. Well, if you wanna go to heaven, well, you can't live like that. So let me tell you, brother, God's gonna get you for that.
God's gonna get you for that. Yeah, God's gonna get you for that. He knows where you're at. God's gonna get you for that. Yeah, God's gonna get you for that. Every wrong thing that you do, God's gonna get you for that.
Now the preacher at our church, he's a mighty devoted man. Everybody thinks that he's a going to the promised land. But the other night on a country road while I was driving through, I caught the preacher making love to Sister Mary Lou.
God's gonna get you for that.
Yeah,
God's gonna get you for that.
There's no place to run and hide, for he knows where you're at.
God's gonna get you for that.
Yeah,
God's gonna get you for that.
Sister Bessie, she likes to testify. She says, I always love the Lord, someday I'm gonna fly. But the other night while going by the local liquor store, I caught old Sister Bessie flying out the door.
God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that.
There's no place to run and hide, for he knows where you're at.
God's gonna get you for that. God's gonna get you for that.
Every wrong thing that you do, God's gonna get you for that.
God's gonna get you for that.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, FM 90.1, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We have one announcement tonight. We want to tell you about an event sponsored by the Chico Housing Action Team. Please show your support for CHAT by showing up for an organic pasta dinner and dance concert. It'll be Sunday, May 15th at the Arc Pavilion, 2020 Park Avenue in Chico. Enjoy the music of the Chris CHAT Band and other top-notch local musicians. Just $20 covers admission, dinner, and live music. Doors open at 5. Dinner starts at 5:30. Music starts at 6. Beer, wine, and desserts will be available for purchase. If you're interested in more information, you can contact Bob at 518-9992 or Sheldon at 894-8429. Leslie Johnson reminds us this is an important fundraiser for CHAT. Your support will help us provide housing for people who have been homeless. If you can't make it but would like to donate, the address is CHAT, P.O. Box 4868, Chico, California, 95927. Ecotopia has been made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Outside Inn, providing lodging in Nevada City. Outside Inn is nestled in the pines just 2 blocks from downtown Nevada City. The inn features theme rooms, hardwood floors, swimming pool, DSL, and lots of ambience. Reservations can be made by calling 530-265-2233 or at outsideinn.com. That's outsideinn.com. And we're supported by Robert Amendola and Associates, a law corporation providing legal representation to accident victims. If you've been involved in a car, truck, or vehicle accident of any kind, the law firm of Robert Amendola, Odola, and Associates is there for you. Call them at 916-924-8787. Hmong translating is available by calling Mr. Wei Yang at 916-599-0039.
And please keep your radio tuned to 90.1 KZFR here in Chico. We have a good evening of entertainment. Natalie will be up next with the storyteller, and her topic tonight is vintage. I'm intrigued. And then at 7:30, we're very happy to have Senor Felipe back doing his program after a brief absence. It's nice to have him back higher where he belongs. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1.
Susan and I will be taking a break from Ecotopia for the next couple of weeks. We're looking forward to having Chris Nelson sitting in for us next week, and Guillermo Mash will be at the controls the following week. We thank them both in advance.
Be sure to check out our website for recordings of previous shows and announcements of upcoming programs. We also have a resources page with web links that have been mentioned by our guests. So when someone refers us to some event or organization or groups who are doing work in the Ecotopian world, Steve puts that up on our webpage. And our webpage is www.ecotopiakzfr.com. And you can also contact us by
email with reactions to our programs as well as suggestions for future topics. The email is ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. I'm Stephen Chudy. Thanks for listening.
I'm Susan Chudy. Thanks for listening.
Weave, weave, weave me the sunshine out of the falling rain. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again. Sing it with me. And the concrete crumble, shine on me again. The proud and the mighty all have stumbled, shine on me again now. Weave, weave, weave me the sunshine out of the falling, out of the falling. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again, fill it again now.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. It's date night at Disneyland with the Elliott Brothers and the Disneyland Date Nighters. Let's dance!
So late nights at Disneyland.
We're open till the clock rocks
1 a.m. Friday and Saturday nights. Live bands at Disneyland
with the Elliott Brothers on the stand.
Under a million twinkling lights. Friday and Saturday nights. Dance slow and dream. Or cha-cha-cha. At Disneyland, the sky lights up at nine each night.
Romantic rides in the cool moonlight.
We're open till the clock strikes 1 a.m.
great at Disneyland. The sky lights up at 9 each night.
Romantic rides in the cool moonlight.
We're open till the clock strikes 1 a.m.